Hello and welcome, ladies and gentlemen, to Overthrows. I'm Behram Kazi, who you can find at Def Mango on Twitter. And with me, as always, is Jared Kimber, who you can find literally everywhere. I'm not going to be taking the episode numbers anymore because this is about to get very random. And we're going to have episodes, you know, out all the time as per the cricket that is happening. So we'll be reacting to the cricket. So welcome to, what would you call it? Phase two of Good Areas, guys. We've got Abdul T.S., Subrat Sharma, Roman Nasir, Hum, Prateek Jha, Jessica Bell, The Nice Man, Rutuj Kusurkar, sorry if I butchered your name, Kusurkar, Prats, and Varun's also around. Sorry for the delay, guys. Jared was stuck in traffic. And yeah, this is probably the longest we've ever delayed this show. 56 minutes.
Oh, it's not the longest I've ever delayed a show. And it won't be the longest I ever delay a show.
Anyway, so this particular Overthrows episode is going to be solely focused on West Indies versus South Africa. South Africa were over in the Caribbean to play a two-match test series. And after the first test in Trinidad was hampered by rain and ended in a draw, South Africa defeated the West Indies by 40 runs in the second test in Guyana to secure a vital 1-0 series victory. And essentially, Jared, they've kept their World Test Championship final hopes alive mathematically.
Yeah, this was the big one. I remember when I did the World Test Championship predictions, there was a lot of South Africans who were really upset that I just didn't have South Africa winning 2-0. Mm. I think now we've seen a draw and we've seen West Indies almost steal a test match. You can see now why I thought there was a chance, even if West Indies didn't quite live up to what I thought they were going to. But they were there and thereabouts, let's put it that way.
Yeah.
But yes, I think South Africa got away with it, really, and can be fairly happy with that, all things considered. I'm not sure when they look back, they're going to think to themselves they played brilliant cricket, but you don't always play brilliant cricket.
There was one South African cricketer who was head and shoulders above the rest in this particular series. Keshav Maharaj was the star of the show. He bagged player of the match, the player of the match award in the first test in Trinidad. And eventually he also got the player of the series award. He took 4 for 76 and 4 for 88 in Trinidad in the game in which he was player of the match. And then he also took 5 wickets across 2 innings in Guyana, ending with 13 scalps at 16 apiece. And, you know, as a result, he's also become the leading South African spinner as far as wicket tally goes in Test cricket. No one has more Test wickets than Keshav Maharaj. And that is huge. And I've like been following his career very, very closely in the last few years. He's upped his game drastically, even across formats. Mm.
You know, I interviewed him in, I'm trying to remember when it was, maybe 2018, was it just before COVID? We were, you know, I was chatting to him there, and he's it's a really interesting guy. He's very professional, very sort of thoughtful about what he says. It wasn't a particularly great interview, but it also, it did allow you to, you know, very much to understand, you know, what kind of a cricketer he was and how he thought about things and everything. And yeah, I know, I thought he was a really, really interesting person. But yeah, back then, I think when I interviewed him, I remember I wrote something, might have even done a piece on him directly. But I remember at the time people being like, "What? Why are you talking about this guy? You know, he's just a South African spinner." And it's interesting how in the last 5 or 6 years, he's kind of shed that a little bit, hasn't he? And he has become, you know, a very, very important player, I think, in the sort of the future of, the president, I should say, of South African cricket. And, you know, they just haven't had in their entire history, you know, spin bowlers, right? And it's taken a long time since the old four leg spinners period, and Hugh Tayfield, I suppose, was there and thereabouts as well. And like, so he has, he's managed to go past Hugh Tayfield, and yet his total's only, what, 171? Am I right?
Something like that. Also, your volume's a bit low, so if you could look into that. I was mighty impressed and have been mighty impressed by Keshav Maharaj for a while now. And I mean, he was always quite handy in Test cricket. That was his format. I feel like he's upskilled big time in limited overs cricket as well. He's been getting some franchise T20 gigs. He was great in the ODI World Cup as well. Well, maybe not great, but he was as good as Kuldeep, if I'm not wrong. If memory serves me correct, that's what we kind of came up with towards the end of the ODI World Cup. And, you know, he was so good as South Africa's main spinner, that no one could really match up to him. Even if you look at the West Indian spinners, right? They did not come to the party. Jomel Warrican took 6 wickets in Trinidad, including 4 for 69 in the first innings. And then he got 2 more in the second innings. And then in the next test, he only managed 2 wickets, right? Guthakesh Mothi, who we expected great things from, you know, when this series was being spoken of prior to it starting. Both of us were quite confident that Guthakesh might have a good series, but he went wicketless in Trinidad and took just 3 wickets in 2 innings in Guyana. And you could make an argument that he batted better than he bowled in this particular series. Even if you combine Warrican and Mothi's wicket tally, it's still too short of Maharaj.
Yeah. And look, I think Mothi was a little bit disappointing. I think certainly in the first innings, I expected good things from him and he wasn't really needed. But a little bit disappointed with him after that. And he didn't bowl particularly well in the first test. Warrican's ridiculous, of course. He has a first-class bowling average of 21. Of course, I think he's a Jamaican spinner and Nikita Miller had a first-class bowling average of about 17. So there is an element there of why those things happen. But Maharaj's average is now just over 30, I want to say, Bayram. I think it's... certainly it's under 31 anyway. That's elite. And considering how much of the time he spent bowling in South Africa, I think that's really, I think he's very underrated. I remember before a couple of years ago, players who could play spin would still sort of take him on a little bit and go for him. I've noticed more and more over the last couple of years, teams just aren't doing that anymore. He's just gone to another level.
Yeah, Varun has confirmed that his average in test cricket is now 30.78, which for a slow left armer, I believe, is quite good. And I mean...
Anything under 32 for a finger spinner, I think is actually exceptional because finger spinners are not wicket takers.
Yeah. Also, the fact that you mentioned he plays his home cricket in South Africa, yet he's hung on to that spot. He plays every test match in South Africa as well. And when they go to, you know, these sort of tours where there's certain surfaces which aid spin bowling, all of a sudden, you know, he started to turn up. And his numbers in the West Indies are also quite fantastic. So he was clearly the headliner as far as this particular series is concerned. But where the West Indian spinners failed, the seamers did quite well. And one of them in particular was exceptional. He has been doing very, very decently in recent times. And he stood out as far as the West Indian seamers were concerned. Jaden Seals took 3 wickets in Trinidad, but then turned up with career best figures in Guyana. Took 9 wickets, including 3 for 45 in the first innings and 6 for 61 in the second. His stock continues to rise. And here's a fun fact for you. His strike rate currently after 15 tests, I believe, in test cricket, is now below 40. He's in Kagiso Rabada territory, which is quite phenomenal.
Yeah, I think his biggest issue is that he's very new ball dependent. But he's such a good new ball bowler that when he gets a breakthrough, he usually doubles up and triples up. And I was going to, when they were bowling first in Guyana, I saw about 20 minutes. I saw before they took their first wicket. I don't know even how long that was now. And just by how much he was moving it, I was just like, oh, this is what's about to happen. He's about to take a whole bunch of wickets here. Yeah. And you can kind of see that. And on other days, he's not quite fast enough. He doesn't have a good enough short ball. He doesn't really have other things to go to. But when conditions are in his favor, he's such a brilliant bowler of the new ball. If West Indies can back that up with a really good first change kite bowler or a hit the deck kite bowler, whatever that may be, Seals is fine. You know, he's going to be fine for a very long period of time. But he does need someone that's going to help him out, like in the attack, that can help him out in that sort of situation. But when that ball is moving, he doesn't need any help at all. And as we saw here, you know, he can be the difference on his own.
Yeah, and he's gotten county gigs as well. I first saw him when Pakistan toured the West Indies for a 2-match test series. I believe it was 2021, if I'm not wrong. It was a 1-1 was the result. And he did quite well in that series as well. And I knew that this could be potentially a special player. We've seen him grow in these years. And in the series versus England, he was their best player. West Indies were not particularly great apart from, you know, some centurions and stuff. But Jaden Seals was consistently good. And now he's doubled up on that with this 9-wicket performance in Guyana. And it's interesting how, you know, Kagiso Rabada also has a strike rate below 40. He now also has a strike rate below 40. Of course, they're like over 200 wickets separating them. But I was watching this little segment during the lunch break or something, in which he actually spoke about how he really idolizes Kagiso Rabada. And he was talking about, you know, how they had a bit of a tussle during the test match and they were exchanging a few words, all in good spirit. So that was nice to see. And, you know, KG, as we know, he ended up on 299 wickets after this test series. Took just 8 in 2 test matches, but it did include 2 threefers. You expect more, but the fact that he's just about to get to 300 wickets, I mean, easily you could see a world in which he overtakes Dale Steyn's tally.
Yes. I mean, he's talked a lot about wanting to be a test match bowler and be thought of as a test match player. And I think he's been a good T20 bowler and sometimes an exceptional T20 bowler, but I don't think it's where his heart lies. And I don't think he's as interested in that as he is in test cricket.
Yeah. He was very vocal as well when Cricket South Africa opted for, you know, their first string players to play the SA20 over the New Zealand tests. And he didn't say it right off the bat, but we saw that a few months had passed and he wasn't happy.
Yeah, exactly. He was very clear that it wasn't exactly how he wanted things to go. Look, there's absolutely no doubt that his strike rate is assisted by bowling in South Africa. Yeah. And I think Dale Steyn is right up there as well as one of the best strike rates in test match history. And obviously he bowled in South Africa as well of recent times. So we know that that is an impact when it comes to the actual strike rate. But Rabada does take wickets in lots of different places. And there's an energy he gets off the pitch that I just think it's one of the more interesting bowlers I've ever seen from that point of view. Like it's I don't know, what's the best way of saying it? It's almost like the ball is alive, if you know what I mean. Yeah. it just has this energy off the pitch. And he's an incredible athlete, but he's also very professional and very clever. And now he's experienced. He should be coming into some kind of a prime, right? Yeah. And to average 22 after 64 test matches. I mean, the biggest crime is that it feels like he's been around for a decade. And if he was in England bowl, he'd probably already have 500 wickets.
That's true. Varun also has a fun stat over here for us. He says that Jaden Seals, interestingly enough, has a better average from overs 21 to 50 than he does from overs 1 to 20. So he's averaging 30 roundabout in the first 20 overs. And then 20.3 from overs 21 to 50. So
I can tell you what that is. Mm-hmm. That's why you need to know more than just that.
Yeah.
Because that's because he uses a Duke's ball.
Oh, true.
So there's a lot of England opening bowlers, and you get this in first-class cricket as well, who actually do better. And Anderson used to be the same, I think, at times. And Sam Curran was another one I looked up in first-class cricket who had a similar record. They're quite often better between overs 20 and 40 than they are with everything else. I'm not talking about when he has a Duke's ball, because he's always dangerous with the Duke's ball. It's one of the reasons why he has such a great average and why he bowled so well in England.
Yeah,
it's more a problem with the Kookaburra ball on flatter wickets. Overall. Yeah,
when the lacquer comes off in the first 10-15 overs when you're playing with the Duke's ball, that's when it really starts.
Yeah, do you know what? He's kind of a perfect Duke's bowler because he gets more sideways movement than a normal bowler because he has such an incredible wrist position and everything else. It just works very, very well for him for a long period of time in a way that maybe someone like Tim Southee would be another option that.
Interesting. Also, you mentioned how he could do with some help. Well, first, I'm going to tell you another fun fact. Did you know that this was the first test hosted by Providence Guyana since May 2011? They played Pakistan, and in a test match where Syed Ajmal took 11 wickets, West Indies defeated Pakistan. That was the last time Guyana hosted a test match. It feels a bit unreal. But what I'm kind of leading into with this fact is that it is back hosting test cricket right in time for Shamar Joseph to play his first test match on home soil. Mm-hmm. He is someone who in the long run could, you know, pair up with Jaden Seals and give West Indies a fantastic option, you know, as a first change bowler. He took 5 for 33 in the first innings of the Guyana test, first ever outing on home soil, including a corker, which cleaned up Aidan Markram, shoulders arms by Markram on that delivery. And what I've noticed of Shamar Joseph is that in spurts, he is absolutely brilliant. Box office. But, you know, if you look at the full sample size, when he's not good, he's just pretty much absent. And his fitness seems to be a major concern from what little I've seen of him thus far.
Well, I mean, I think he gets cramp almost every time he moves.
Exactly.
So it's not particularly ideal, is it, from that point of view? Look, I think he's a rhythm bowler. Hmm. And I think you can put him in that sort of Muhammad Siraj and Stuart Broad category of when they don't exactly know how it's working, But when it is working, their best ball is basically unplayable at test level. The problem is he doesn't have that sort of Stuart Broad ability to pull back and bowl as a stock bowler. And he's sort of more in that Muhammad Siraj camp of, and he's younger than Siraj, right? At least Siraj has been around for a while and tried to work all this sort of stuff out. So he's in a position where he's trying to work all these things out over and over again. And he probably doesn't exactly know what he's doing. I remember a while back writing a piece on Cricket Info and saying, you know, it was about a different player. I said, but this player is still learning. And this guy's like, you're at test level. You shouldn't be learning. And it's like, well, that's not his fault.
Yeah.
If you're picked ahead of your time, it's not your fault that the selectors have done that. And in Shamar Joseph's case, we might see 3 or 4 years, or even, you know, Siraj is still trying to work it out. And Broad never really worked out the rhythm thing, did he? All Broad knew was that when it was working, no one could hit him. And when it wasn't working, he had to come up with other ideas.
Yeah. I mean, I have high hopes from that boy from Barrackarra. What a story. And I mean, I'm glad that in his first, you know, test match in Guyana and first test series in the West Indies as well, actually. I feel like he's only ever played abroad thus far. He did end up getting a fifer, so that'll do his confidence well. And, you know, I feel like, as you said earlier, maybe South Africa even got away with it over here because it's not like a lot separated the two teams, right? It was quite neck and neck for a vast chunk of this test series. In fact, in the second test, when South Africa were reduced to 97 for 9, there was a 63-run partnership for the last wicket between Dane Peat and Andre Berger. And then West Indies were 104 for 9. And they ended up with a 40-run last wicket stand between Jason Holder, who ended up with 54 unbeaten runs in that innings, and Shamar Joseph, who got dropped on a duck and then started swinging it. So up until that point in the test, 304 runs had been scored and 103 had been scored by a last wicket partnership. So you never really see that.
It's ridiculous.
Yeah, it's not a very frequent occurrence.
If you are following my work, we know that you are a true cricket sadist and you need your hit every day. And sometimes, sadly, there is actually no cricket to watch. So how about if someone made a very fun game that you could use for the moments when there is no on-field action? Welcome to Hit Wicket, a strategic game of cricket, which isn't about slamming your finger on the screen very fast. You work out what works best based on how cricket actually works. Dot balls lead to wickets, ones and twos to fours and sixes. So there is no way you can bowl a great Yorker every ball or smash three sixes at the beginning of your innings. This is proper cricket. Yet it still has some gaming powers in there as well. Hit Wicket is about playing, but also building and managing your team. You are the batter, bowler, owner, coach, and captain. It's your dream. No ads, just cricket. So download Hit Wicket today, because this is a cricket game made for you and supported by major cricket nerds. Also, just in general, what makes the West Indies continually believe that Shamar Joseph is their worst batter? He's just clearly not. It's a small sample size, but from what I've seen of his batting, he's not the worst in that side.
If we did the number 11 script picks like a year later, he might have made it.
Exactly. No, look, I think it was a bizarre game. And as I said before, I thought South Africa, you know, kind of got away with it, I suppose, in a few different ways in this series. Not that I don't think they were the better side, because I do, but I don't think there was that much in it. I thought one of the more interesting stories was Dane Peat, who, you know, here's a player who... So I talked to Dane Peat. I was commentating the minor league final in America, whatever that was, last year, the year before, about, you know, a while back now. And Dane Peat was one of the guys we were co-commentating with. And he was coming on and was talking about his future in America. What a turnaround it has been for him to be where he is now. It's a fascinating story that we've seen and how quickly it's all changed.
Yeah, I mean, it was that test series, right, versus New Zealand, in which South Africa sent a depleted team. He did well. He retains his spot. Simon Harmer, again, is out of favor, clearly. And now he's getting these runs. I don't think he's ever going to be their frontline spinner on home soil. But at least when they travel, especially in conditions that turn, Dane Peat can expect some more test matches in his career. Anyway.
Yeah.
Yeah. We've talked about...
No, I was just going to say, I mean, yeah, you're right. Never going to be the frontline spinner. Not really expecting to be the frontline spinner. But you know, that ability to come in when they need a second spinner. We should point out he bowled about four overs in this game. Hmm. So it's not that his bowling was massively tested, but just again, you know, made runs, just such an interesting story, sort of modern South Africa, right? You know, a spinner who, I don't want to put words in his mouth, but when I talked to him on air the last time, he was quite angry with South African cricket and the way that they dealt with spinners and everything else. And I think it played a part in him going over to Major League Cricket. And now he's back and being really, you know, quite an important player for them in a couple of series now, in a couple of different ways as well.
Yeah, this was rather interesting or fascinating because his 38 runs in that first innings in Guyana might be the most important runs any South African batter has scored all series, because if not for that 63-run partnership, you know, had they just scored 20 runs, they would have lost by 3 runs, right? And it's interesting how this the series really didn't have much for the batters in it at all. The first innings in Trinidad saw South Africa score 350 plus. Tony DiZozzi scored 78. He was also the leading run scorer in this series with just 163 runs. So that tells you the story. In that same innings, Bavuma got 86, who, by the way, is batting at number 4 now. That's also interesting. Tristan Stubbs baz-balled his way in the third innings to a 50 ball 68, which I found really entertaining. And then Markram and Virena also scored a couple of half centuries, or not a couple, one each in Guyana, but that was it. Like, no other batter did anything. Bedingham failed, and even the ones who got to half centuries, that was it. It wasn't like they were getting two. So no. I mean, very, very tough series for the batters.
No, I think it's huge for Tony DiZozzi. I think they are not, I think they've got high hopes for him, but I don't think they were completely sold on him in the way that they perhaps were for Bedingham, I know, who made no runs in this series, or even Stubbs, who, you know, they're willing to take a chance on.
But I think you do DiZozzi, have to consider that DiZozzi got dropped like 10,000 times as well.
I was going to say, I mean, I think that matters more for us than it does for them and him, because, you know, so far in his career, he just hasn't made any runs, right? So I don't know. He's maybe played 7 tests now. He's not got a high average in those tests. Here he's gone away in what was a tough series and actually put some runs on the board. Even if it was only 150 in 4 innings, he got starts in the other innings and everything else. That's a really, really important thing for them. Especially, I remember looking at it a while back, and I think South Africa had worse batting numbers. Trying to remember who the countries were, but I think they had worse away batting numbers than almost any other nation at one point. So I mean, their players were actually doing okay on tough home pitches, but just won't make any runs when they traveled. So again, DiZozzi will take this. And I do think he's a player that that has a lot of talent going into the future.
Yeah. I mean, they might have only scored 5 half centuries combined across 4 innings. But if you look at their competition, right, like, ultimately, what, South Africa won the series by 40 runs, right? And the West Indies just had 2 scores of 50-plus. We already spoke about Jason Holder's valiant effort, how he was unbeaten on 54 when he took the West Indies to, like, what was it, 144? So the deficit was only 16 after that. And the surface started to ease as well after that. So it was an interesting kind of plot twist. But apart from Holder's effort, it was just Alec Athanase's 92 runs in the 4th innings in Trinidad, which allowed West Indies to secure a draw. And I mean, it very well could have been a South African victory in that test as well, because one wicket brings 2 and sometimes 3 or 4. And that has been the trend in this particular series as well. So, I mean, that knock was important. It helped West Indies save the game. But if you look at this side, there is promise. It's just that the batting is not up to par at all.
No. I mean, you know, if they were going to win a test, it was going to be stealing it with their bowling.
Yeah.
And this was probably the ideal start. And they didn't quite get there. I didn't think their batting was terrible, though, as in for them.
I suppose, but that's, you could make exactly what we said when the England series ended.
Yeah,
their batting wasn't terrible for them.
I mean, they're not very good at batting. Do you know what I mean? Like, there just isn't a lot of what you would call top-line international batting talent there. Alec Athanase, you talked about him making, what was it, 78, 82?
92. Career best.
Yeah. What did he make in the series?
119 runs. So in the next 3 innings, he scored, or well, in the other 3 innings, he scored, what does it come to? 19 runs in 3 innings?
Not many, I think, is the best way of putting it. So, you know, there's an issue there that is quite clear. Kartima, I think Kartima is their top second top run scorer or their top run scorer?
Jason Holder, I think, was this.
Was top.
Yeah, was top. Yeah, yeah. I think no one scored.
So Carty was the second top run scorer and didn't make a 50.
Yeah.
Right? So it's the same thing we've been talking about for a very long time. They just don't make runs when they need to make runs. And it's obviously, it's a huge issue. Their bowlers keep them in games and sometimes will even steal games from them. Mm. And occasionally they will get an innings from Holder is a good one. Athanase, obviously. Kevin Hodge is probably joining that as well.
Brathwaite like has been failing.
I was going to say, guys like Brathwaite and De Silva probably won't make a lot of runs, but they will occasionally partner with one of those other guys. But Mikael Lewis is, in his 10th first-class game?
And very, very young.
Is that right? 12th first-class game. Right? I mean, he's been great so far, considering his experience. But how do you compare that to, so Bettingham's had a bad series, and Bettingham would be, a couple of years older than him, and he's played 100 first-class games, and we wouldn't consider him very experienced, right? Mm-hmm. So it's just hard.
It is quite hard, and the nature in which, West Indies lose their wickets at time where they're just swinging at it or there's a very, very ugly looking inside edge, onto the stumps. That's, I understand that, it is a cricketing culture which is very free flowing and they go for their shots. But I mean, on these sorts of surfaces, maybe you should, play within yourself a bit more. I felt like there were times in this test match, the last one, where the West Indies looked quite good. And there was a world in which, you were thinking, perhaps they can really take this deep and even win this, especially when Mothi started hitting those boundaries. But then again, if not for Mothi's, 45-run innings, they should have lost this test match a long time ago, right? It shouldn't have gotten that close either. The deficit was 40 runs towards the end, but it could have easily been 100. And there's another reason for this. Now, granted that both of these teams, South Africa and West Indies, dropped a plethora of catches in this entire series. It was dropped catch after dropped catch. The home team clearly needed those catches more because I do think, like you, that South Africa were the more skilled unit or better team overall. And they were tons of half chances as well that the West Indies could not capitalize on. Also, they got lucky at certain times when Shamar Joseph got dropped on a golden duck by Bakram, right? West Indies went on to put, 40 runs thereon. There were moments where they could have, seized the game and maybe kind of put South Africa under pressure. But time after time, there was this one moment in which they've dropped a sitter or the ball has gone between second and third slip. Stuff like that. Mm. Which would really be draining for a supporter of West Indian cricket.
Yeah. I mean, so I just want to get to the batting and then we'll go into the fielding a little bit off the back of that. But you talked about their batting sort of playing bad shots. Essentially, Kevin Hodge and Athanase might be their two best actual batting talents at the moment. We don't know much about Lewis. So let's just say that he's not quite at that level. They're incredibly limited players. So there are times in that series against England where there was no mid-off really for Athanase because England was saying, we don't think he can hit us down the ground. Now, he actually did start to hit the ball down the ground, but it was, you could see he was playing a different style than he normally plays. He plays square of the wicket. And Hodge is basically waiting for short balls, almost every ball as well. And to be fair, he's about 4'5", so he's going to get quite a few of them even by accident. But they're very, very limited kinds of players. And because of that, you certainly have a situation where they just don't have the ability to be able to put any pressure back. And when you come to, that's what the fielding matters, right? Mm. If you had like a 10% below par batting lineup with this bowling lineup, you're going to take probably enough catches, even if you're not a great fielding unit, to not make any difference. If you're 30% below batting team, and I might be being friendly there, you're going to have to take every single catch in a series like this to be able to steal it. And that's the issue.
Yeah. Even though Aidan Markram was also dropping catches for fun, but still, I feel like the West Indies could ill afford those missed opportunities. And just one final point on the West Indies is Craig Brathwaite and his form. Now, he's been a very, very, distinguished test match opener in the last decade, and even more so for the West Indies, because you don't have a lot of people averaging over 35 in that team, right? Maybe he might just be the only one, actually. I have to check this, but that could very well be true. He, in his last 10 innings in test cricket, has what, 5 single-digit scores, and he hasn't really clicked at all. This is a guy who has been a mainstay for the West Indies, is their captain. And the fact that he's under so much pressure, I mean, what do you see happening over here? Do you see a world in which he loses his job?
Who would you give it to?
That's the better question, because Holder is not going to captain again. The Pacers are young. Kemar Roach is probably not going to play every test match for the West Indies here on. He's probably going to play a test per series or something, or maybe he just retires and plays some more county cricket. And then you've got like young batters as well in Athanase, and well, Hodge is a bit older, but Hodge is also new to the sport or test cricket.
I think it'd be a huge ask for Hodge to suddenly captain. Brathwaite's quite interesting because he should be in his batting prime. And he's not making runs at the moment. But he did sort of, it feels like he's been batting the same way since he was 15 or 16. and I just wonder if, you know, there's a technical thing or a physical thing that isn't quite working for him 100% at the moment. And because of that, we're seeing this dip. It's not like he dipped from a massive height though.
Yeah.
Right?
So that is true.
What has his average ever been 40? I wouldn't have thought so. I would have said, I'm just trying to bring it up now. His average 37
is
maybe?
Yeah, his 38? Average is dropped now. It has dropped to 33.57. I remember it being over 35. I mean, that's not too long ago.
But think of the number you just said.
Yeah, that is also
you true. Remember it being over 35. It's not like he was ever a 45 batter, you know, and for any period. I think he had a good period. In his late 20s, and he's had a bit of a regression. I wouldn't be overly worried unless he's worried, if that makes sense. So if he's saying, I don't know why I'm not making runs anymore, then I think that's when you start to go, oh, this could be a problem. Whereas if I think he's saying, oh, look, my knee's hurting and my back lift is coming from a different spot, or I'm finding it hard to concentrate, or whatever that may be, then you can just try and fix the issues with him. But realistically, he should be in his prime right now. So this is a real worry for them because Brathwaite in his prime, let's say he averages 38 in his prime, right? You have him, you have Athanase, let's say, averaging 35, and Kevin Maholder averaging 33. These are not big numbers. It gives them something to bowl at.
Absolutely.
Right? If he drops down to, you know, what he's been doing over the last couple of years, you're suddenly, it means Athanase and Kevin Hodge and Jason Holder and Josh De Silva, who you can throw them all in there, are just going to be in too early, right?
Yeah.
And so in 2022, he averages 62. And in his 13 tests since then, he's probably averaging about 27, 28 would be my guess. So a lot of that bad form has been in 2024. Now that's playing in England and Australia. And against South African bowlers. So, again, this is why, if he's not worried, I'm not worried, if that makes sense. If he just says, look, I've gone up against a lot of really good opening bowlers. They've worked me over in conditions at times that have also helped them. And he's like, but don't worry. I should also say, he has done this before. So there was a period at which, I remember I was going to write a big piece for him in Crick Info around 2017. That's right. Because I've been following him since he was 16. And I was like, just about to write the big piece. And then he did not make a run in 2018, 2019, or 2020. And then he's had 3 pretty good years after that. So he might just be a player who sort of goes up and down a little bit when it comes to those sorts of things.
That is interesting, because you said the same thing about Usman Khawaja, and you have a theory that Babar Azam might be the same kind of batter where, you know, they're cluster batters for a period in between. They're really, really good, and then the drop-off is significant after that, and then they're good again. So interesting to know that Brathwaite has something similar going on for him.
It's just a different kind of pattern, and it's not as, you know, it's funny, I was looking at Joe Root's record. So Joe Root has a 3-year period in his late 20s when you would again think he's hitting his peak. He actually kind of drops off quite a bit, right? But Joe Root was really good for about a 4-year period before then, and it's been really good for a 3 or 4 year period since then. Yeah. And then you've got, that's a different kind of pattern than you would see for a standard player would be Ricky Ponting, who comes in a bit early because he's such a ridiculous talent. He's fine, but not spectacular for a long period of time. Then Ricky Ponting has the highest peak of any player outside of Bradman, really, you know, over a long period of time. And then drops off and becomes a very ordinary player. That's a more normal peak. Whereas, as you said before, Usman Khawaja and Babar Azam and some other players, they kind of toss and turn a little bit. And sometimes I think it can be as simple. It's not quite a form thing, if you know what I mean. But it's their mind is clear, their body is working, and their technique is following. And they can they keep that up for 2 or 3 years, and then suddenly it goes. And that's why batters freak out. You know, the great story, of course, is John Wright gluing his bat, his glove to his bat handle, right? Because he wanted to feel his hands on the bat like that all the time. Batters know that they're chasing that, and I do think there's probably an element of that in this sort of the Craig Brathwaite thing. Just briefly, I can't remember. Medissa didn't put it in a super chat, but said, "What about Shai Hope? Shai Hope played 38 Test matches and averaged 25."
Yeah. And right? If you take the Headingley test match out in which he got 200s, maybe that average drops even further.
Honestly, I think it's worth trying him again. And the reason I would try him again now is because he's in that, I think he's a better bat now than he was when he was young. But if you're asking why he's not in the side, it's because he played 38 test matches and he averages 25.
Yeah.
Sometimes you just need to take the slips out and bowl defensively. And you also need to be careful with your computer's defense as well. If you need a VPN, go Nord. NordVPN.com/Kimber to get a 2-year contract with a discount, plus 4 extra months and gifts in some markets. It's completely risk-free with Nord's 30-day money-back guarantee. The link is in the show notes. So put in some dot balls and turn them into maidens via NordVPN.com/Kimber.
But yeah, it is an experiment worth taking, I feel, because he has really, really improved in the last couple of years in limited overs cricket. So I can only imagine that he can bring his average in test cricket up by like 10 runs or something at the minimum at this point. All right, so before we wrap up this series review, there is one player that I want to talk to you about. I don't know much about him, but he's still 26 years of age and he is someone who Dale Steyn rates really highly. Has had comparisons to Jack Gallis in the past, which probably haven't, you know, helped him at all. And he had his best ever test in Guyana. He's played 14, by the way, and this was his best one. Wiaan Mulder, he had a, you know, brilliant test, player of the match effort. South Africa won a series away from home as well. And he had career best figures of 4 for 32 in the first innings and then took 2 for 35 in the second. He's not particularly quick at all. Very, very gentle, military medium. But he was very, very effective on the surface in particular. And he scored valuable runs in the lower order throughout the series as well, which has been a bit of an Achilles heel for South Africa in the past. So what do you know about him and what do you think is his role in the South African team going into the future?
He reminds me a lot, and only South African fans are going to remember this guy, although I think he did actually move to New Zealand and try and make his professional cricketer in New Zealand, is a guy called Obas Pinnar, who at a very young age, he's a left-arm bowler, who at a very young age had phenomenal first-class numbers, but ultimately probably wasn't good enough to bat in the top six and wasn't probably fast enough or penetrative enough to be in your top four bowlers. And so South Africa sort of have a lot of those sorts of players. And Wiaan Mulder so far in his career, and remember, he's only 26, and I've talked about a lot, all-rounders develop later.
Yeah.
But you look at his overall numbers, and he's batted a lot at number 7 and number 8 in first-class cricket, right? If you're batting at number 7 and number 8 in first-class cricket, you can add one spot or even two spots when you get to test cricket, right? Now, he's also batted at 5 and 6, but he's not starred all that much with the bat in those positions so far. I think he's averaged in the 30s when he's gone up the order. He hasn't had two seasons where he's averaged over 50 in first class cricket. He's had, I think, he might have three now where he's over 40, and that's with a softer batting position, right? So I think there's an element there of how does his batting fit in when you look at that sort of thing, right? And then the bowling, I think you've already talked about it. What was the guy who played for Australia who was actually a South African, but Hilton Cartwright?
Yeah.
There's a little bit of that Hilton Cartwright. I see Jessica's just put in here the Justin Kemp sort of thing again. And the thing is, it's just like, what's Leon Mulder's best role? He probably is a fifth bowler and a seventh to eighth batter. Hmm. And that is a bit of an issue. Now, where it's not an issue is probably England and the West Indies. Because of the Duke's balls and it nipping around a little bit longer, I think he's always going to be dangerous in those sorts of conditions, I would believe. But I don't think he is really I think he's going to struggle to take wickets regularly at first and second change in Test cricket with the way he bowls at the moment. So it's that position that they've been in with Ryan McLaren, who was the other guy that Ashwin destroyed? Stian Van Zyl.
Yeah.
Robin Peterson.
Hmm?
Do you know what I mean? Like, it's those sorts of cricketers. None of those are bad cricketers. They're all, in fact, they're all terrific first-class cricketers.
Paul Harris.
Yeah, Paul Harris is, maybe even something else. But Paul Harris played when Callis was there, right? If you had Callis in this side, you could say to Callis, we only need you to bowl 10 overs a day, but can you bowl as fast as possible for those 10 overs? Hmm. And then we'll get Leon to do all the crappy overs between the 60 and the 80th over. You don't have to worry about any other dog overs. Hmm. And also, because Callis is in the side, the batting is automatically a little bit deeper as well, right? Yeah. They can, you know, play around the batting. So it's really hard to be that solo player. I think he's okay, but I think he's going to need another player to back him up. So maybe he needs, what's the wicketkeeper's name?
Kyle Verena.
If Kyle Verena is like an absolute gun, right? And maybe becomes a great number six, for instance, then you could start to play with that sort of Leon Mulder role a little bit more. But I'm not sure, looking at everything I've seen in his record, that he's probably not maybe more of a number. I think he's probably a number eight, maybe a number seven at a pinch, but not in every test match. And my memories of him, and I didn't see as much of him in this series. He was never on when I was watching. But my memory of him, and I'll go back and look at MV Play at one stage, is that he was a much better, that he's a fifth bowler rather than a fourth bowler. A very good fifth bowler, because I do think he's a skillful fifth bowler. But he reminds, I'll keep throwing these sorts of players out. Andrew McDonald.
Yeah.
Right? Andrew McDonald was a fantastic first-class player. It's just a little bit tougher when you get to test level to be able to get those skills, because if you're not a great fourth bowler, suddenly you're a little bit not as useful. And then you've got the fact that your batting has to be much better. And generally those guys bat at 5, 6, 7, and 8 in first-class cricket. That is not a spot that you really want anyone to bat if they're going to bat at number 6 or 7 in a test match.
Yeah, I mean, when South Africa are playing their home test matches on spicy surfaces, you have the temptation to just go with an extra bowler rather than someone who can shore up the batting, especially when, you know, Marco Jansen is available and he can kind of swing it around, so they can potentially play him and compromise on a bit of batting. And then you've got, you know, other really, really good promising bowlers in Nandre Berger. I really like him, and they needed a left-arm quick. Right? Even though they've never had one for the most of their history, and now they have two. So that's interesting. And Rabada's still around. And you've got fringe players like Duan Olivier, right? He's still there in the circuit. I might be even forgetting someone at this point because there's so many.
Ngidi,
right? See, Ngidi's top draw. Nokia probably won't play a test match again, but Ngidi will.
I mean, Nokia should play test matches again. He was a fantastic bowler when fit. If he's fit, I would play him in test matches. But yeah, look, I think the Marco Jansen thing is really interesting, because Marco Jansen and Leon Mulder at 7 and 8, if one of them can manage to average 30 at 7, and that's a big if, and the other one can average like 26 at 8, that almost can work, and that gives them a huge flexibility, right? But that's what I was saying before. You have to pair it up with someone else. because he's not going to, from everything I have seen of him, I don't think he's a certainly a top six player, and I think he would struggle about number seven in Test cricket and make a lot of runs, and I don't think he's a strong enough bowler.
Yeah, I think that checks out. Also, that completes our talking points for West Indies versus South Africa. So let's take some super chats before we move on. We've got Keshav Huria. Is that a super chat, actually? No, it's not. We've got the nice man who is asking, will Virat Kohli get to 40 test hundreds and will Rohit Sharma get to 20? So is Virat at 30 right now or 29? Somewhere around there.
I don't know. I'm literally Googling it to see how many test hundreds he had. I couldn't tell you on a day-to-day basis how many test hundreds anyone had. It's not a stat that I particularly would look at. So he would need 10 more.
Yeah, 30.
Let's just do it mathematically. He's getting about 10 hundreds for every, 35, 36 test matches he plays. So if he played another 40 test matches, he could get 10 more.
Yeah.
That seems like a lot from here, but, you know, it depends. He's very fit and he's very motivated. I wouldn't say he couldn't do it. What's Rohit got? Sure, I know that as well.
I don't know that on the top of my head. I just know Kohli was in and around 29-30 because all the big or Fab Four batters were like very close to each other within touching distance. You know what? Like, if they win the World Test Championship next year, if they make the final and win it, both of them might retire. They might not chase these records, right?
It's very possible. Look, Rohit needs 8 more. I would say it's probably unlikely for both, just based on the World Test Championship as one, but also just on their age. It's a lot of test matches to get when you're beyond your best, right? Like, as in peak years. And Rohit might be one of those guys who actually is better in his 30s than in his 20s.
Yeah.
You know, there's a lot of reasons why I believe he's that kind of batter who could be like that. Virat, I kind of think, needs his freak athleticism to continue to still be a great batter. But yeah,
I think I agree. And you never know, like, if they lose the final again and they want to play another cycle of the World Test Championship and they go crazy, it's not beyond the realms of possibility either. Anyway, Rishabh Sharma asks, do you think non-contact sports like cricket can ever be more popular than contact sports like football, since players in the latter are more expressive and you get more powerful characters, thus more relatable? I disagree. I think you get so many powerful characters in cricket, perhaps even more because the focus is on one single player when they are either batting or bowling.
Yeah, I mean, are we really saying that Messi is more expressive than Virat Kohli?
Yeah.
I mean, you know, even Ronaldo. Ronaldo's pretty expressive. Is he more expressive than Shane Warne? Like, I don't really understand that. Yeah. That feels like someone who doesn't like cricket as much as he likes football, which is fine. That's you know, different way of looking at things, and more than fine. Football's more popular than cricket, partly because it's easier to understand, partly because it's 90 minutes, because it can be zero all the way through until the last minute, and then things can happen. Like, there's, you know, football, and if you look at it around the world, most football codes are the most popular sports, whether it, you know, be rugby union in New Zealand or Aussie rules football in Australia or NFL in America, right? Like, football codes are generally, because of the way they are structured, seem to hold people's interest, especially casual fans' interest, far more than other sports.
That's true.
But cricket's the second most popular sport in the world. If, you know, I mean, it can fight with basketball if you want it to, but it's in the top three most popular in the world. So I don't really understand the point of a question like this. And I don't see what the non-contact... So, I mean, I watch football and all I see is people falling over and crying all the time. Yeah. So, I mean, like... And I'm saying that as someone who's not a football fan, right? Like, I watch football, they're near each other, and then someone goes down clutching a leg for 5 minutes, right? Like, give me cricket where you have to get hit in the head or in the nuts to do that. So... Yeah. It's not for me, mate. I don't get it. I don't understand that. So, I think you're coming at this from a very different way than most people would.
Yeah, I don't know what the contact, non-contact thing has to do with anything, but what I said earlier in cricket...
Is football actually a contact sport? Like, they barely touch each other. Because basketball is not considered a contact sport, and basketballers hit each other as much as footballers do.
No,
right? Unless you're talking about American football, that's a contact sport, right? Like, or rugby.
I think football counts as a contact sport, even though it's gotten, like, they've made it more safe, and there has been some new legislation with respect to, you know, what is, you know, a malicious foul and that sort of stuff. But I mean, cricket is one of those rare sports which focuses on just a handful or a couple of cricketers at one given point, right? Because every ball or every delivery is an event and it is only played by one batter and bowled by one bowler. So I think it kind of puts the spotlight on these sports persons even more than these other sports that you talk of. And we can get to kind of assess and view their characters more frequently. Anyway,
I just had a look. Apparently, basketball is also considered a contact sport.
That's what I thought. Non-contact. I thought basketball was considered a contact sport.
Yeah. So I played football and basketball. Mm-hmm. I wouldn't consider, and I played Aussie rules football and I played rugby, right? I can tell you which ones I consider contact sports. Mm. And it isn't football or basketball. Like, I'm not saying you don't get hit. Like, you know, in football, you do get kicked quite a bit and everything. And in basketball, you get a screen that can knock you flat, right? Mm. But you playing Aussie rules football and someone's just picking you up and throwing you, that feels very contacty to me in a different way. But
absolutely. Anyway, final super chat of the show, Path Right Winger, who makes it a point to always send us a super chat. So thank you for the generosity, Path. He says that he does not agree with Schrodinger's Kohli and thinks that Kohli could have gone faster. Bowlers such as Bumrah won India that game from a position where South Africa required 30 of 30, and that Kohli has played hundreds of these innings for RCB, and no RCB bowling would win that game.
I don't think he understands what Schrodinger's Kohli is.
Schrodinger's
because
Kohli.
You can't agree or disagree with Schrodinger's Kohli.
Exactly.
The entire point is that was either an innings that was going to win them the game or an innings that was going to lose them the game, and we don't know at the halfway point. Mm-hmm. Like, I think he fundamentally doesn't understand what Schrodinger's Kohli means. He needs to go and have a look at Schrodinger's cat. Yeah, yep. Pavlov's dog, Schrodinger's cat. I always get those two confused. And I understand what we're trying to say. What we're trying to say is that an innings like that, and a perfect example would be with 30 balls to go, it did look like Kohli had lost them that game.
Yes.
Right? But at the end of the game, if Kohli hadn't batted the way he had have, they might have also lost that game, right?
Absolutely.
You can't have, that's the problem with those, with the way that we look at T20 innings and ODI innings sometimes is it doesn't quite go straight the way that you think it should. And that's the point of that. And it really depends on your personal way of looking at it. And that's the thing with Schrodinger's cat is Schrodinger has put the cat in the box, right? And if you are, you can be the sort of person who thinks the cat is dead, or you can be the sort of person who thinks the cat is still alive, right? It depends on you, right? So you can't disagree with Schrodinger's Kohli. Because that's not how the thought experiment works.
Yeah. Also, just think of Schrodinger's Kohli path as a double-edged sword. Because at that point where India had posted 170-odd, if they had lost that game, all of the swords would have pointed towards Virat Kohli and he would have been public enemy number one because he was, 50 or 48, something like that, before he went berserk at the end. And because India won that game, that innings is now hailed as a very mature knock in which he kind of assessed the situation, took the innings deep and allowed India to get to 176 in the first place, which Bumrah and the other bowlers then, you know, helped India defend after 30 of 30. So it goes both ways. And that's what makes it such a fascinating knock. And that too in a World Cup final, in a T20 World Cup where Kohli made lesser runs in all games combined as opposed to the Schrodinger's Kohli knock. So anyway.
And just on that, we did a video about the Kohli in the IPL. The interesting thing about the IPL is the IPL is a very fast scoring competition. And it makes him look worse when in actual fact, international cricket is much more slow scoring and it makes him look better. So it's not just about the Bumrah effect. It's actually about the entire speed of the game. And so international cricket suits the way he plays more than the IPL does, which is something that should be talked about more.
Yeah, Bath, if you want to go check that out, that is a Footmarks called King Kohli's T20I Legacy, something like that. And Jared has a separate video on it as well, if I can recall. But there's definitely Footmarks on it because I was on that one as well. Yeah. So it is a very, very interesting T20I career. But to Jared's point, it is a lot better in internationals as opposed to domestic T20 comps. Anyway, that wraps up our itinerary for this particular Overthrows podcast. Thank you to all the people who came in the comments and sent us super chats. And just a quick reminder to everybody, you can go to goodareas.co and bookmark that webpage, and that can prove to be your one-stop shop for all the work that we do as part of our team, whether it be written content, podcasts, or videos. We'll be back with another Overthrows soon enough because cricket never stops, but that is all for now. Goodbye.
thank you for listening. This podcast has an ad-free version via Patreon, where there are also many other extras as well, including a Discord channel where you can chat to me directly. There is a link to the Patreon in the show notes. We are an independent podcast, so support us any way you can. Maybe give us a review, subscribe, or share on social media. All of these things help us. And when it comes to podcasts, word of mouth is always the best way of making it grow. If we had a guest on, chances are their socials are in the show notes. Please support everyone who comes on this show. I am Jared Kimber, and this is my network. But we also have hosts and co-hosts like Bairam Kazi and Estelle Vasudevan. This network is overseen by Nick McCorriston, and each episode is produced by Ishit Kaburka at Sound Potion Studio. Mukunda Bandredi, or Muku as most people will know, is the head of our YouTube channels, and he also helps out with so many other things like the podcast recordings. And there's so many other people we could thank here, but I just want to thank all the listeners and all the people who help behind the scenes that make this podcast work. If you make any content, Minbo Pro is the tool for you. Take your long format content and cut it and slice it for social media. This AI-inspired weapon will turn your one piece of work into so many clips. Try Minbo.pro now.